From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, featuring Tom Scheinfeld, Mills Kelly, Amanda French, and Dan Cohen.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
This is Digital Campus number 74 for the 19th of September, 2011. Tin Badge for the Authors Guild. And welcome to another edition of the Digital Campus podcast from a suddenly fall day here in Fairfax, Virginia at the Roy Rosenzweig Center for History and New Media at George Mason University. We're delighted to be joined by our regulars, Tom Scheinfeld. Hey, Tom.
Hi, Dan.
Mills Kelly. Hey, Mills.
Hey, Dan.
And Amanda French.
Hello, Dan.
Hello, Amanda. And a very special guest on the podcast, joining us from the West Coast. I believe you are on the West Coast right now, Tom. Is that correct?
Well, I'm not exactly on the coast. I'm a little inland, but I'm very close.
And that is the mellifluous deep voice of Tom Merritt, joining us from his studio, or the studios of Twit, I believe. Listeners to the podcast may know Tom from a long and illustrious history in the tech world and in the podcasting world, starting with Tech TV and then CNET, and most recently joining Leo Laporte at This Week in Tech, where he has a show called Tech News Today, right?
Yeah, Tech News Today.
So welcome, Tom. Welcome to the podcast.
Well, thanks for inviting me along. I hope I'm smart enough to hang with y'all. You guys are you're good at what you do.
Well, thank you. Also, since we have two Toms, we decided before the podcast to call you Team Mayor.
You're really going to do this.
Is that T Shine? Did I just hear T Shine?
You did.
All right, I think that was the rap of T Shine coming through the mic. Oh,
this is right. Embarrassing.
Yeah, we could have done S and M, but then that could lead to all kinds of
Yeah, I know. Okay. Well, actually, Tom, since you're in, I guess, the mainstream tech news world, I'd like to just follow up in a story that we spent a lot of time on in the last podcast, which was our take on the kind of sunset of Steve Jobs at Apple. And what we focused on, because this is a podcast that focuses on education and academia, was this really interesting history of Apple, where we looked back in the archives and some of these incredible early videos of Steve Jobs at Apple when he was 26 or 27. And a lot of those marketing videos that he has are really about orienting Apple toward the education market, something that I think a lot of people forget about, that really Apple sort of got its start and was dominant in the 80s in education first. And I think now, they're really viewed as a kind of consumer computer market. I assume we're probably roughly the same age. I assume you got started on like an Apple II or something like that. And
yeah, I walked into the Kaskaskia Community College summer youth education computer class and was given a iconic choice. One side of the room had TRS-80s and the other side Apple IIs. And without any other information, they said, just told you to choose a side.
Wow. And what do you make of this, the kind of shift that's happened in the last decade or two, where Apple's really gone from, perhaps a marginal player in the overall consumer market, which is dominated by Windows, to really having, I guess, forgotten really about the education market and this history. Has that changed the way you sort of talk about Apple, or the way it sort of shows up in Twit podcasts?
The way Apple has changed has been to become a consumer electronics company instead of a computer company. It was always Mac versus PC. That was always the storyline up until the iPhone came out. When the iPhone came out, suddenly it became about the iPhone. When you're talking about Apple, you're talking about the iPhone. And even today with the iPad, And even before that with the iPod, it wasn't the same as the iPhone. The iPhone has entirely changed Apple's business. It's entirely changed their perception. And I think the reason Apple was so focused on the education market in the 80s was because that was their best chance of selling a large number of computers. You could sell quite a few computers to homes, but you weren't going to sell personal computers to businesses at that time. The businesses were going for IBM. They wanted big iron. So if you looked at the education market, you said, aha, here's a place where we can, you know, can outfit a school with a computer lab. We'll fight Tandy for those contracts. And Apple kept a big focus on education for quite a long time. I remember even when I was in college in the late 80s, early 90s, they were the big vendor when you went to the college computer store. They had the best deals and they had the best marketing. I guess that has faded somewhat. They used to have the educational oriented machine they sold, and they've retired that. It seems like Apple still has a nod towards that, but they have become a consumer electronics company, and I think it's twofold. One is they don't need to sell to the education market to make their money, and they're also not focused on computers anymore. And they do work with schools for iPad and iPod Touch. I've seen lots of stories about that, but yeah, it hasn't grown while the rest of the business has. I guess that's the way I would look at it.
Right. You know, you bring up the iPhone, and I'm teaching a large class with a lot of freshmen in it, and I sort of asked them about their experience with computing. So these are people who were born, scarily enough, in, you know, 93, 94. And they think of Apple as the iPod company. I mean, and now the iPhone company. But this is the first generation, if you look at a 17 or 18-year-old, that their experience of music is the iPod. They don't even remember CDs, really. They started straight into digital music, MP3s, and for them the iPod was what they got, you know, when they were 10. It's sort of their Apple II. It is really interesting to see how much has changed.
I had a bit of a brainstorm, Amanda and I actually, while we were sitting around the developer table yesterday about this. And there actually is something I think that ties that 80s education market strategy to the maybe, you know, 2000 consumer electronics strategy. And that's, they're sort of still selling to the same people. And that is 18 to 24-year-olds. I think they've just realized that 18 to 24-year-olds would rather buy music and iPods rather than computers to write their term papers on. And so there is sort of that. I think some of the skills and some of the marketing savvy that Steve Jobs and Apple built up over the course of the 1980s in selling to, you know, that market that everybody wants to be in, those 18 to 24-year-olds, they have been able to take that experience and parlay it into success in the consumer electronics market, where that, again, that age group is so important.
That's a really good point, because you don't have to sell to the educational institution or through the educational institution for the students to afford it anymore.
Right. And they cut out that middleman as well. Yeah.
And that's true. It's true that Apple still gives really good education discounts every fall back to school. They always have, it seems, some kind of buy a computer for your first year in college, and we'll throw in all kinds of discounts or all kinds of consumer electronics. And it's weird, you know, because I'm such an education nerd, I kind of got into consumer electronics through the computer, the Apple computer, because I bought my first generation MacBook back in 2006. And part of the reason that I bought it, I was kind of waffling on Apple versus Windows. And part of the reason I bought it was because they threw in an iPod Nano. And so that was where I first got my first iPod and started listening to podcasts, and the rest is history.
Mm. Well, and I think also increasingly the iPhone is selling the laptops. You know, these are kids who, they got the iPhone when they were 16, 17, 18 years old, and they already had an iPod. And so then that just sort of bonds them into the company. And so when it's time to have their laptop for college, they pick some kind of a MacBook.
Yeah, I don't know if it's a causal relationship, but I did start on the Apple II, but I moved from there to a Commodore 64, to an IBM PS2, and was in the Windows universe until 4 or 5 years ago when I suddenly switched to a MacBook Pro because of boot camp and I could run Windows on it, but also because I had an iPod and then I had an iPhone and it all seemed to work well together. And eventually I flip-flopped to where I don't boot into Windows anymore. I boot into OS X, but I still have both on there.
Interesting to look back at these histories and how much your sort of computing life is colored by these early experiences. Reminds me of this paper I recently read about how the whatever music you listened to when you were 13 kind of sticks with you really intensely.
Oh no!
And I know.
Yeah, to my scary, that scary to think. Distress.
It's the Huey Lewis and the News looms large in my legend.
John Cougar.
Oh, Mellencamp.
I think it's
no. He was just Cougar.
you're stuck with Cougar.
The Cougar. We're the Cougar generation.
This is
going down a bad road. All right. Well, let's reset here on the podcast and get into some of the news from the week. I hate to turn this into this week in law, but there were some really important developments in, I guess, the ongoing and unfortunately escalating battle over the fate of digital books, especially in university settings, where the Authors Guild, as I'm sure everyone listening to the podcast knows, has a long-running, I mean, it is scary how long-running this lawsuit is against Google for their digitizing of, at now, over 15 million books have been digitized by Google at places like University of Michigan. And in fact, they had a status call on this yesterday. It's still ongoing. So since 2005, we're in the sixth year, entering the seventh year. It looks like it will go to trial in 2012. The lawsuit that the Authors Guild and the American Association of Publishers has against Google. But for the first time this week, in a, I think, sort of a strange and unsettling development, the Authors Guild, although not the publishers, went ahead and actually sued the universities that are providing the books to Google. These are, you know, very prominent, oftentimes public universities like the University of Michigan and University of California at Berkeley. And the digital tower or service that they created called HathiTrust, which is a service that they've created to pool all of their Google scans into a single service. It's administered by University of Michigan and I believe Indiana. They have the digital books replicated in two locations in case something goes wrong. And the idea behind HathiTrust was to be able to serve digital copies of these millions of books to students, staff, and faculty on these campuses and other campuses that join the HathiTrust Alliance. This week on Monday, really out of the blue, and from what I've heard, this really was unexpected because the Authors Guild was talking to these universities about these digital copies that they're storing in addition to the ones that Google is storing. But really unexpectedly, the Authors Guild went ahead and filed a lawsuit against five universities and HathiTrust, claiming that they were, as a rather histrionic press release had it, they were abducting and releasing to thousands of students and scholars these books. And really what we're talking here about,
they've been doing that for years in print and no one has stopped them.
Do you know these thousands? I mean, it really is. I should read some of this, but 250,000 students now have access to Robert Ming's 1937 edition of the History of Uzbekistan.
Do people and they're going to read that instead of going to the Michigan game.
I know. No, I was thinking of this. If you have looked at the attendance at the University of Michigan football games this fall, they're way down because of HathiTrust. There's a lot of people
that explains
staying
it.
Inside.
What was happening.
No, it's really kind of empty.
These
unlimited downloads to their
iPads. Well, because when you had to leave your dorm to walk to the library to get the book, you would get distracted into going to the game. But now that you can just download it at home.
No, it's... Yeah. So, I mean, it really is written in this language of, I guess, you know, echoes of the RIAA about, you know, worrying that Britney Spears was being given, you know, or had unlimited downloads to students. But these books in particular are what are often called orphan works, which I suppose we should explain. It's not particularly a great name, but these are generally older, out-of-print books whose authors or publishers are really the rights holders, which is a kind of different matter entirely, cannot be located. And they're kind of in an unclear realm in the copyright law. Technically, they're still in copyright. They were published after 1923, which is when the public domain works begin, or before 1923, all books are in the public domain. But after that, a lot of them are orphan works. In other words, they're still technically in copyright, but the rights holders can't be found. And the universities thought to enable scholarship and to, yes, enable students in their pajamas to download these books at 3 a.m. rather than going to the University of Michigan library, that they would make these old out-of-print books available online through HathiTrust in a secure fashion. And the Authors Guild evidently doesn't like this one bit. So, Amanda, we talked about this a little bit last week. We didn't know that this lawsuit was coming. What's your initial take on this?
Well, my initial take is, ah, you've got to be kidding me. I mean, that's my take on it. And I mean,
but what do you really think, Amanda?
Yeah. Wait a second. I'm transcribing this podcast. Yeah. Or closed captioning.
So you're lucky.
Three A's, an R, two G's, and five H's. Okay,
I think there's
got
some Z's in there as well.
Yeah. Well, why is it so frustrating? I mean, okay, I'm just going to play the devil's advocate here.
Right.
And I also find it hilarious that the Authors Guild is led by Scott Turow. So, you know, as I was joking on Twitter, it's a good thing they weren't led by Mario Puzo. Who knows what would happen to those librarians rather than lawsuits. You know, I think one of the concerns they raise is, and I think it's sort of implicit in their press releases, what happens if a hacker gets in and releases these 7 million books to the internets?
Yes. this is the thing, is that HathiTrust actually comes under quite frequent criticism for not making books available enough. So HathiTrust basically, you know, all of the libraries that allowed their books to be scanned by Google, part of that agreement was they'd get copies of the scans back. And all of the libraries that were participating in this project kind of threw them all into this one pile called HathiTrust, which, by the way, is derived from the Hindu word for elephant because it's such an enormous thing in the room. So HathiTrust actually only makes its scans available to the communities of those institutions. So there's lots of people who say, you have these public domain scans, why can't the entire internet read those? Why can't the entire world read those? And that's because, you know, well, that wasn't in the agreement with Google. So there's definitely, you know, echoes of the whole Aaron Swartz thing in this, where there's a whole faction of people who think that if something is public domain, then it ought to be freely available, free as in beer, available to the public. And so it's kind of ironic, you know, and I kind of, you know, I lean in that direction. I'm not fully in that camp, but I lean in that direction. So then it's always surprising to me, and it shouldn't be surprising to me. It's a good thing I'm not a lawyer or in charge of a major library like this, because yeah, it did shock me that, you know, here you kind of think, how could anyone object to this? Because I had read articles about how carefully Michigan was researching these books. And we have a little, you know, addendum to that. But it seemed like they were very carefully trying to figure out if they could find copyright holders for these works. There are, you know, several articles about, they had a whole copyright review project. They had many staff. They had tens of thousands of dollars, I think hundreds of thousands of dollars in funding for this effort to try to even determine which works are orphans. So lots of times you take a book, you're not immediately certain who the copyright owner is. You do some research. Sometimes you find that it's actually in the public domain and you didn't know it. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not going to get this exactly right, but it's something along the lines of, if it was published in the U.S. between 1923 and 1963 and the copyright was not renewed, then it's in the public domain. But you kind of have to check all of those. Now, that's different from an orphan work, because an orphan work is nobody knows who the copyright holder is. Very often, Mills, you've been talking about this in terms of Eastern Europe, very often it's the publisher owned the rights, the publishing company went out of business, and when it went out of business, it didn't assign the rights. So there's these things that are in total legal limbo, and, you know, universities have these digital scans of them. And what Michigan very bravely decided to do was, we're going to make these available to our own community, not to the entire internet, but to our own community. And they have the physical book on the premises. So it's really not that much different from, you know, I mean, a student could go over and read the, you know, 1937 history of Uzbekistan in their pajamas if they wanted to, but they don't want to. So why not make that digitally available to the students? It just seems like such a no-brainer. They're not harming any commercial market because these books can't be commercially exploited either because, you know, the copyright holder can't be found. Michigan, I thought, was doing a very good job. They were publicizing these books. They say, hey, here are these books who, you know, which in our best determination are orphan works, meaning the rights holders can't be found. If you are the rights holder, let us know and we'll remove this work from our list of orphan works. So it seemed like a no-brainer to me. It seems like Paul Carat, the head of the Michigan Libraries, was quoted as saying something. It seems like a no-brainer to do something that doesn't harm anybody and is going to do a lot of good for some people. But it's not a no-brainer to the Authors Guild, which I hear starves and beats its apprentices.
Well, we should add, as I think...
As a medieval guild.
Yeah, it's yes. A medieval guild. And I love how it's called a guild. Yeah, so, you know, I guess we should add, as late breaking news just about an hour ago before recording this podcast, HathiTrust did pull, at least temporarily, the Orphan Works Project, which, as Amanda mentioned, was the project to actually list just the titles of the books that eventually, 90 days later, they would release to students on campuses that have a physical copy of the book. I mean, we need to keep emphasizing all of these restrictions. They are not making it available as a BitTorrent here for the general public. But they did pull it after the Authors Guild successfully found some of the authors on the list. Although, also, as Amanda's pointed out, we're not necessarily sure that just finding an author means that they're the rights holders. I mean, this is what's so incredibly complicated about this situation is a lot of people on the Authors Guild blog, you know, were pointing out, oh, I found the granddaughter of that guy who wrote the Uzbekistan history. Well, we don't know that the granddaughter has the rights to it. We don't know that Robert Zing, you know, renewed the copyright in 1950. We have to do some checking on that. We don't know, as I think, and I'd love to hear from Mills on this because, Mills, you deal with these books from places where the publishers don't exist anymore. It just becomes nearly impossible, I think, to find some of these authors or publishers.
Well, and in the case of Eastern Europe, it's not even just that the publishers don't exist, it's that they were nationalized by the Communist Party and, you know, by the government after 1945. And so then all of their assets became state assets, at which point the question is, does that make all of those published works government documents and therefore automatically in the public domain? Mm. So or the publishers were, you know, Aryanized by the Nazis after, you know, 1937 or 1938. Who owns the title to all of that work, especially if all of the owners whose business was Aryanized, if they're all dead, which is often very common.
This doesn't mean that the Authors Guild is on the side of communists and Nazis.
No, absolutely not. those kinds of issues do.
I'm just draw your own conclusion.
Right.
It makes it even harder.
You know, I blame the 20th century. The 20th century was just too complicated and had too much history. If it weren't for the 20th century, we wouldn't be in this pickle.
You know, in answer to your question, Amanda, of sort of why the Authors Guild is going after, you know, Michigan and HathiTrust, I wonder if these two stories aren't more closely linked. The story about, you know, the Google suit actually going forward, that the settlement's done, they're going to trial, and this you know, counter suit against HathiTrust. I wonder if it's not almost a legal tactic. Like when there was a prospect of a settlement, you know, the Authors Guild was sort of waiting for that to happen and seeing, you know, and Google had a deal with the universities and they were sort of waiting to see where that all turned out. Now that the suit is actually going forward and it's going to trial, I wonder if the Authors Guild's lawyers didn't tell them, well, it's not going to look good in court if you're going after one party that has the money and you're not going after the other party that doesn't for the same thing. You have to be, you know, you have to be going after these alleged copyright violators uniformly to sort of make the rhetorical point that you're not just out there for the money. You've got a kind of principled objection, principled legal objection to this. And you're going to go after anyone who you know, supposedly violates these copyrights. Go ahead, Tom Merritt.
No, I was just going to say, it does seem to be taking a page from the RIAA and the MPAA as far as having a very aggressive stance and going full tilt in every legal direction you can go, not because you think you can win every case, but so that you set the bar as far away as possible. And what the Authors Guild wants to do is protect the copyright of its members. How that relates to protecting orphan works from being made accessible to students in a limited fashion, I agree with Amanda. I don't see how it connects. But if you're a lawyer and you say, look, I don't care if it connects or not, I am going to push my settlement as far away from the protected group as possible so that my group is protected 100%.
Right,
exactly. That's a common aggressive legal tactic, and it seems to be what they're up to here. Corinne McSherry on the Electronic Frontier Foundation reviewed the lawsuit against HathiTrust today and says it doesn't even look like they have standing to sue.
Exactly.
None of the parties that they claim are under threat are party to the lawsuit. None of the authors who can experience the great and irreparable injury are party to the lawsuit. Even the folks that, hey, they have come forward and said, hey, this wasn't an orphan work and you had listed it as so, they are also not party to the lawsuit. So it's hard to imagine that they could show harm in this case.
It's actually, I think that's an excellent point, Tom. And I actually think that may be a reason why they filed this lawsuit too, is that I think the Authors Guild wants the right to speak for all authors, which they clearly don't. I mean, every one of us on this podcast, we have all written books, book-length documents. Mine is not published. I think you guys are all more published than I am. But we don't, I mean, the Authors Guild doesn't speak for us. And I don't think the Authors Guild speaks for very many authors even. And the Authors Guild doesn't really speak for publishers. Dan, you pointed out that, I mean, the AAUP, the American Association of University Publishers, didn't join this suit. I mean, I think there are other publisher groups for commercial and trade publishers. They're not joining this suit. And most of the time, they are the ones who hold the rights to these works. So I almost feel like they probably filed this suit because if they gain any kind of recognition as the kind of organization that has the right to file such a suit on behalf of all authors, then that will be a gain for them.
Yeah, Paid Content yesterday reported that the publishers were not joining the Authors Guild in the lawsuit and that they were near to an independent settlement with Google separate from the Authors Guild.
Right.
It's interesting. That was always a weird kind of unholy alliance. And you know, in my experience, like, authors and publishers have, you know, a very uneasy relationship. They have different interests. That always seemed strange that they were in this together, because in so many other ways they're not in it together. It's like musicians and record companies. You know, they work together because they have to, but not because they, you know, have any great love for one another.
I mean, I keep wishing that, so I'm an author of a book, and I wish somebody would digitize it, because then it would be widely available.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, that's really the thing. As a person who's written something, I don't know if I want to full on claim the title of author since an actual publisher hasn't published it, but it is in my best interest for the most amount of people to have access and the ability to read it as possible. I don't want the Authors Guild to say, well, you've written a book, therefore we speak to you for you. And they've said that before. They said, we speak for every author, that if my book got digitized by Google, that I would have to go to the Authors Guild and apply to receive the royalties they would be collecting on it. And that's just ridiculous. You can't just have someone pop up and say, I am now going to speak for everyone, whether they want it or not. And I'm going to collect money on their behalf. And guess what? I'm going to keep that money and put it in a bank, draw interest off it. And if they don't claim it in a certain amount of years, I'm going to keep that money. Although if it's an orphan work, you can't ever have access to it. It's incredibly hypocritical.
I assume, Tom Merritt, that you would, you've written a couple of books, and I assume, you know, you'd like to make some money off the books. You'd like to have, you know, have them have some impact, have people tell you like them, et cetera. But I would think that after, let's say, 20 years, you wouldn't mind it if the University of Michigan had a copy on their shelves or a digital copy in HathiTrust, right? I mean, you'd want that document to have some life, and the libraries are the only institutions in the forever business.
My personal feeling is that copyright should be about 14 years. and then everything should go in the public domain. And I followed Cory Doctorow's lead on this. When I remember to do it, I take the stuff that I've written when it's 14 years old and I dedicate it to the public domain with one of the Creative Commons public domain licenses. And I also put out everything I've written in Creative Commons form for free on the internet, because I realize that it's an infinitely copyable medium and it's ridiculously stupid of me to try to stop people from making one copy of something that's digital. You just can't do it. So you have to find other ways to make the money. And of course, it's not because I'm some hippie who's like, I'm just the information, you know, I'm going to let it out. The signal has to find a way. I do want to make money, but I am rational enough to understand that trying to lock down a system that is not meant to work to imitate physical objects is not the way to make money off this stuff.
Well, we liked you.
It does seem that, just the question of the standing of the Authors Guild is really going to come into question next, because, again, without turning this into This Week in Law, but over the summer there was a case that wasn't followed as much as the Google case called Literary Works, which was a suit of freelance writers against databases like LexisNexis, where they claimed, these writers claimed that they were including their copies of the articles in the database without authorization. And this was another case that had been kicking around the courts for a long, long time, for many years, decades. In fact, it made it up to the Supreme Court 10 years ago. The case imploded because these writers couldn't really claim that they were a valid class, because there are so many different kinds of writers who are in LexisNexis, right? I mean, there are some writers who want their stuff to be there. There's other writers who are ambivalent and others who want their stuff out. And it seems like this is another case. In fact, a lot of lawyers who are looking at the Google case and the HathiTrust case carefully are saying, you know, they're going to have a problem. The Authors Guild is going to have a problem saying that, you know, Scott Turow or Stephen King is in the same realm as Dan Cohen or Tom Merritt in their book writing. So.
Yeah, I mean, in this case and in that case, the Lexis case, and in others, I mean, even the Walmart case that was decided over the summer, you know, the courts have been rolling back these class action suits and denying standing to some of these classes, to making the standards for justifying a class much higher. So I tend to agree that this probably just isn't going to fly as a class.
So what about the flip on this of if the publishers and authors got together and created, and this is another story that broke this week, of potentially creating a kind of Netflix for books. I mean, an actual for-pay system where you could sign up for $99 a year or $199 a year and get all the books you can eat or read. Amazon seems kind of interested in that idea. What if that is part of the settlement eventually with Google or with Amazon?
Well, first of all, it bugs me that everybody keeps calling it a Netflix for books, because I think it's an Audible for books. Amazon actually owns Audible.com, and I have a subscription to that. I pay $14 a month or something like that, $14, $15 a month, and I get basically one credit toward an audiobook every month. Now, I am enslaved by my Kindle at the moment. So I think if I'm giving Amazon many times that $15 for audiobooks, for ebooks. So I think I'm worried about Amazon making enough money off of this. I shouldn't be, but I buy so many sort of single ebooks from Amazon that even as a Prime member, I don't know how they would make any more money off me from this kind of thing. But, you know, I think it is a good idea. All the news this week was reporting only that Amazon is trying to do this. I will be surprised if they can manage to do it, because I think publishers will resist it, particularly if publishers have been looking at the music industry, where, you know, Apple really had a lock on ebooks on music for a long time with iTunes. Amazon has that lock on ebooks and on, you know, audiobooks already. So I think that publishers, are already really wary of giving Amazon any more power than it already has. So I'd be I'd be surprised, not shocked, but a little surprised if Amazon actually manages to pull this off.
I'd be surprised because the publishers don't seem to ever want to agree to anything that's a change, even if it means more money to them, because they just fear changing the model too much. A couple notes to what Amazon is doing that are interesting, though. They will not have new books in this subscription service. I think that's probably the best way to think about it, because the idea would be you're an Amazon Prime member. So for your $79 a year, in addition to free 2-day shipping and access to their video streaming service, you would get a limited number of books that you could read at no extra cost per month. But they would be from a library of older books. And the enticement that Amazon is putting out there for the publishers is, let's say George R.R. Martin comes out with his new book, we'll put all of his old ones in the subscription service so people can read and catch up and then want to buy the new one.
Well, I mean, that's all very well, but what I'm really hoping that Amazon will provide is a 1937 history of Uzbekistan.
I don't think anyone is allowed to read that.
Okay.
It's illegal for you to even suggest it.
I've got to download that book. I've got to go get it from the library. It's so
I got a bit torrent of it.
Yeah,
especially because before they lock it down, you got to get it now.
That's right. Get it while it's free. But yeah, no, I think the Amazon service is intriguing. I'm not sure how many people would really take advantage of it. I'm not sure how much money Amazon can afford to pay the publishers for it. I don't know how authors get compensated. Is there a tracking system? And if your book is read more often, do you get more money out of it? It looks like Amazon wants to pay a flat fee. So it's an intriguing idea, and I get why Amazon wants to do it. They're trying to turn their Amazon Prime service into more than just a free shipping option. They're trying to turn it into a membership club that is much, much more than a Netflix, where you're just paying for streaming videos or DVDs. You're paying for this incredible world that Amazon is going to deliver, possibly through an Amazon Kindle tablet that they would come out with later.
I worry. I guess my feeling with it, I mean, I would use this service if it was available. I've got my Kindle. I already rent movies and stuff on my TiVo and on my Roku from Amazon. I mean, I do all this stuff. I've got Prime, you know. So I would use it. But I guess what I would worry about is what does it mean for kind of the future of the public library? Like, isn't it the public library, your local public library's job to, you know, lend or quote rent books?
Again, this is my screaming day.
Okay, that's two. That's a record.
No,
that one was spelled differently, though.
But it is a little, you know, it's a little worried. Like I thought that's what libraries did.
No. Look, okay, everybody associates libraries with books and books with libraries. But the truth is that libraries have been doing a booming business in loaning and renting DVDs and CDs and that kind of thing for a long time. And yep. That coexisted perfectly well with renting movies from Blockbuster, renting movies digitally, streaming from Netflix. I mean, I really don't, I see that all over the news and it drives me nuts. I really don't see why being able to rent ebooks would affect public libraries in any way.
I think it's different when, you know, if it's a choice between me driving to Blockbuster and paying $4 to rent a movie or driving to my public library and paying $0 to rent the movie, you know, I may choose the library. But if it's the difference between, you know, if I can just get it, like if it just shows up on my device and Amazon can provide that facility and the public library kind of can't, although they sort of can, but it's not as easy as all that. Then I think it is a more difficult choice.
Well, here's the thing. There's for us who are at the kind of top of the income chain, it's nice to be able to save some money by renting something instead of buying it, but it's not going to be that big of a difference. It's not going to make that big of an effect for us. For you know, we are in a terrible recession. You know, the economy is terrible right now. The difference between free and cheap for some people is a very, very important difference. And the thing about public libraries is that they are one of the only places you can go to get on a computer if you don't have a computer, if you don't have internet access. So libraries, you know, there's all kinds of statistics that shows that attendance at public libraries is up. It is not dwindling at all, you know, because of this, you know, plethora of ebook content. Libraries are used more and more and more by people in the lower half, essentially, of the income range in this country. Libraries, you know, libraries are providing job search help. They provide like workshops and, you know.
I'm not suggesting it's going to kill the public library. That's not my point. My point is just that I wish the libraries were being more aggressive in this direction. Like, I think this is the role the library should play. I'm not sort of saying, you know, that this is necessarily setting up a big competition between these two. I wish the libraries were more in the game.
Anyone used OverDrive from their public library? I think it's the only time I've almost thrown my iPad out the window and like stomped on it. it is the most frustrating thing. So this is the promise. It sort of shows you the promise of this from your public library. For people who don't know about this, OverDrive is a service that provides access to essentially rented books from your public library for free. So public libraries, in our case, Fairfax County Public Library in Virginia, signs up with OverDrive. They pick a certain number of books. They tend to be very high circulation books. And then you get an app for your iPad or iPhone or Android device, and you can download the book for free from your public library's website and store it there for up to 3 weeks. But it is the most annoying. I mean, it's worse than trying to go to your public library and getting, you know, the new Malcolm Gladwell book when it comes out. You're never going to get it. It operates just like a physical book system where you have to, when you check a book out, no one else can get it, even though it's a digital copy. There are other restrictions, and I think we've mentioned this on the podcast before, that OverDrive has had to obey from the publishers. Like, once a book has circulated 26 times, it disappears from the database for some reason, unless you pay again. So it's, you know, it shows that promise of just, you know, turning on my iPad, getting free books from my public library as I would do physically if I were to walk over there. But you can't actually ever get anything you want. Yeah. And it strikes me that, I don't know, maybe the publishers are leaving some money on the table. I'd be willing to pay, you know, whatever, my $99 a year to actually get a copy of the damn book.
Well, here's a question. If you're a publisher, would you rather make it easier for libraries to lend books for free through OverDrive? Or would you rather give yet more power to Amazon and, you know, make this rental service happen?
If I were a publisher, I'd be like Tor, and I'd make my books available for free as PDF Creative Commons license downloads and actually see the sales of my books increase as a result of it. But I don't think the publishers think the way I do.
At least until the revolution, when the state takes you over.
They're looking at all big corporations. I think they're looking at next quarter's earnings. And
that's
so
absolutely, yeah.
They like Amazon better than the public library option or the Creative Commons option.
Yeah, they want to be able to defend themselves to their shareholders over short-term earnings, and in that limited view, all of these decisions make more sense. Of course I'm going to make a deal with Amazon. Of course I'm going to limit what libraries do. Of course I'm not going to give away any digital files for free, because the shareholders aren't going to understand a long tail view or the fact that the internet is going to eventually change all these models, whether we like it or not. The shareholders are going to say, why did you give away this stuff for free? You know, why? And our earnings could have been better. And you have to defend yourselves to them.
Well, look at what happened.
Pickle we're in. Yeah.
Yeah. Look at what's happened just recently to Netflix share price. And, you know, over the last couple of days, like where they, you know, they've announced that, you know, we're taking this long term view. We've made this business decision because we believe the future is streaming. But like, so they changed their pricing model and they lost some customers as a result. You know, I think it's probably a good idea in the long term for Amazon, or at least they think it's a good idea in the long term. But Wall Street is pissed. So I think that, you know, these are the kinds of decisions we're faced with from these big corporations.
And I'm proof that the publishers need to start taking whatever profits that they have and investing them maybe in oil and gas leases or something like that, because just yesterday afternoon I spent an hour and a half learning how to create an ebook. And Tom Merritt, you don't know, but of the people on this podcast, I have the least amount of tech skill. And so, I mean, I have more than probably the average person in the world, but certainly not the average listener of this podcast. And in an hour and a half with some open source software that I got from Google Code, I created an ebook that looks great. And so, you know, a 2-hour class at the local community college could teach everybody how to do that.
sure.
without any difficulty. And it looks great. I was shocked at how easy it was. And so if the bar has been moved that low, then it's just a matter of years.
I've actually been seeing some indications recently, which I hope will fulfill their promise. I mean, there have been a number of stories lately about people who have decided to self-publish, like authors who have just decided to self-publish. I was just reading a story this morning about some British author whose name I've forgotten, who had decided to drop her publisher after her current contract, 3-book contract, expires, which is pretty soon, because they've been marketing her books as chick lit, and she doesn't think they are chick lit, and she's going to be a self-publisher. And she's, you know, she's a good, like, mid-list author in the UK. There was some kind of kerfuffle a few days ago about somebody, you know, a blogger, an author who was blogging about all the kind of mistreatment of her, you know, by her publisher. You know, who knows if the story was legit, but she claimed that her publisher had raked her over the coals for doing some self-publishing on Amazon, even though that wasn't covered by her contract that she had with them, all those kinds of things. So I keep, if the internet really is the disintermediation engine that we've been told it will be, it may be starting to do that for authors.
Well, the Washington Post had a story called like Digital Goldmine or something like that in the last couple of months about authors across the genres, everything from bodice rippers to serious nonfiction to detective nonfiction. And these authors are making a lot more money than they would have made had they gone through conventional publishing houses. So they clearly have talent because they're making a lot of money. Their work is selling well at $1.99 or $2.99. But they're getting, of that $2.99, they're getting something like $2.35. And you know, if they'd gone through a publishing house, they might have been getting $30. So they're thrilled. They would not, and some of them had published with conventional publishing houses and then left. Others had never done that, had just put ebooks up and started, you know, put them in Apple's bookstore, and they started selling.
Such a good discussion. I think I've got to award all of you a Digital Campus badge for intelligence.
Oh no!
Yeah, no, that just happened. Oh god!
Achievement unlocked.
That's called a segue.
I think, Tom, I'm giving you a gold badge for, you know, just jumping right into this podcast and never having talked to us before, and really having fantastic commentary. And Tom, I'm sorry, Tom Scheinfeld, bronze badge for you. Today you've been a little bit off.
Ooh,
Amanda the Screaming notch you down to a silver badge. So I'm, of course, talking about our final story before we wrap up. Some quick thoughts on the new digital media and learning competition launched by the MacArthur Foundation and with the involvement of Mozilla, providing the badge, the open badge system. Tom Merritt, did you discuss this on your podcast, or is this just like an inside baseball academia thing where we're really interested in certifying each other with certificates of achievement?
You know, we haven't talked about it on Tech News Today, but it is definitely the kind of thing we've talked about before in other arenas. I see it as the gamification of education. This idea of like giving badges, giving achievements to people as a way of encouraging them to participate in whatever it is that you want to do.
They
don't know.
Get them to level up.
Yeah, I mean,
the Secretary of Education said that, Mills.
Yeah, they used
he
that
literally
language.
Used
yeah.
Term level up.
All right. You know, my kids, my teenage boys, they're going to be so excited about this.
Well, gamification is a hot topic right now, which is because they look at things like World of Warcraft, the Xbox 360, and they see just how excited people get when they get this freaking GIF that shows up and says you did X. It doesn't give you any advantage in the games that you're playing. It doesn't give you any kind of monetary value, any kind of like, points that you can exchange for stuff. It's merely a badge of honor, and people will compete viciously to get them. In fact, there's people in World of Warcraft that's all they do is they pursue the achievements and they try to unlock all the achievements that are issued by Blizzard. And so because of that, people are like, well, this is a really low cost way to motivate people to do things. Where else can we apply this?
Yeah,
I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead, Amanda.
Oh, so I was hanging out recently on a sort of a consulting gig with Ethan Watrall, our That Camp Great Lakes friend, who is very well known for doing what is often called serious games, which is a slightly better term for it than educational games. He's working on a really neat project right now. I've forgotten who the funder is, but it's an epidemiological game. It's it's like this game they're developing where there's a disease spreading through a town, and one of the neat things about that game that they're developing is you get to be the disease, as well as like the doctor and a person in the town or anything like that. So it's kind of neat. At any rate, he was talking about this term gamification, and it is a big buzzword, and it is a big buzzword in education as it is in a number of different places. And his point was that a number of the people who have been doing, literally gamification, are Ian Bogost and people like that are pretty much against it, partly because they know how difficult it is to quote unquote gamify things. Like, making a video game is actually a very expensive procedure. Making a really good video game that, making Angry Birds was not cheap. Making Farmville even was not cheap. These games that people get really obsessed with are multi-million dollar productions when it comes down to it. And a lot of that production, sure, does go into psychology. They do endless testing. If you've ever listened to the developer commentary for Portal or Portal 2, they'll tell you, we tested this and it didn't work, and we tested this and it didn't work. And a lot of the people who are into gamification kind of think, oh, well, we'll create an animated GIF and give it to people when they do well, and then we're going to wash our hands and go home. And that's not going to work. So I'm a little off the topic of this particular MacArthur thing, but honestly, I'd like to hear Mills talk about it. What do you think, Mills?
Well, okay, first of all, I will just add one other thing. In addition to badges, my cousin Matt runs the, if you've ever watched Red versus Blue, he's one of the founders of Rooster Teeth Productions, and on their website, they don't give out badges, they give out karma points.
Uh-huh.
And it's nice. Kind of, it always reminds me of, the Seinfeld episode, the show about nothing, and, it's going to be a show about nothing. And that's kind of what it is. All this stuff is a show about nothing. But the thing that Tom Merritt pointed out, it matters to people. And so I'm not, I'm not quite as caustic about the whole thing. I think that, the effort of MacArthur is, as I read it anyway, is to focus on lifelong learning as opposed to replacement learning. Like, we're going to replace some aspect of the school curriculum here or some aspect of the college curriculum. Instead, it's kind of ongoing learning. And there may be people who propose replacing various modules in school. And, there are a lot of kids who really do need some other motivation than what they're going to get from their regular teachers in their regular classrooms. I sure see that, in my own kids' schools. And so,
can you explain what it is that they actually are proposing doing?
Right now they're just proposing you should go and tell us what you want to do. And so that it's a pretty wide open competition. But one thing I would say, though, that worries me a little is that there's a story that broke just recently on NPR about the whole learning styles industry, which really in many ways goes back to work by Howard Gardner that's got to be, 15 years old at least, about people, you're a visual learner, you're an auditory learner and all this. And I know students come into my office and they say this back to me. Well, Dr. Kelly, I'm an auditory learner. I'm a visual learner. I'm a manipulative learner. And there's a psychologist at University of South Florida who decided to test this proposition. Are people really visual, auditory, whatever kinds of learners? And not only could he not replicate it in the laboratory, but going back to the literature about learning styles, there's no evidence that there is anything like a group of people who are visual learners or auditory learners. There's no scientific evidence for this. He says in this interview in NPR, I'm not saying it's not true. I'm saying there's no evidence that it's true. And this has created a storm in the education industry, because education is in America is predicated on this idea that students have these different multiple intelligences, and you see it on, which comes from Gardner, and you see this on the MacArthur website, is that, working from these theories, well, what if these theories are nothing but theories? And so yes, I think the game part and getting the badges as a motivator, that may actually have some real benefit, especially for motivating this new generation that's grown up with all of these games to continue exploring things. I'm okay with that. Whatever gets them to do what we want them to do is good, especially if it's something free like a badge or a karma point. But if it's predicated on something that is a theory of learning that's just nothing but a theory, that's a little more problematic, I think.
Tom Schoenfeld, you had an interesting comment about the, I guess, the superficiality that you saw, and maybe to answer Tom Merritt's question about really what is this, I think their idea is that they're opening up, you know, a really open system where, you know, I could go out and give a badge for digital humanities because, you know, I've been doing it for 10 years and I could sort of certify that, that, you know, Amanda has achieved some certain level of that. It's supposed to be an open system, and I guess to make the whole system of learning non-hierarchical and to, you know, make it available to other people in a kind of peer-to-peer system. But Tom Schoenfeld, you had some kind of issues with the superficiality of that process.
Well, I think it is an open system, and I think that's one of the good things. I do think that it's probably a good thing to have entities other than colleges, universities, K-12 educational institutions, certifying, you know, people's credentials. I think having a more open credentialing system is probably a good thing for society. in terms of what the competition, it seems like what happened was MacArthur gave some money to Mozilla to build a platform upon which competitors in this competition will be able to define and build achievements that will then be fed through Mozilla's open badging system to be distributed, carried out by people on the web or in the world. And then the badges will be distributed and certified through that system. I guess it is very much framed as a lifelong learning kind of program. I guess my biggest problem with it is not necessarily that I think it may encourage some people to do these things. Some of the rhetoric around the program was that this will help employers. This will help the participants in the program. Get in the it'll help them in the workplace. It'll help them in the job market because they'll be able to show to employers that they've, you know, I've got the JavaScript badge or I've got the digital humanities badge or I've got, you know, whatever badge it is. And I guess as somebody who hires people, hires programmers, hires researchers, I guess that's not what I look for when I'm hiring people. The reason I hire a programmer is not because they've, you know, completed this particular Microsoft certification course. I hire them on the basis of what they've done. It's not the skill. It's what you've done with the skill that I think really matters to employers. And so when you make education so granular, which this badging credentialing system does, as opposed to synthetic, which is something I think that I like a college education does, I think you take away the opportunity for people to demonstrate their creativity, to put these skills together in interesting ways, and then that becomes the proof of their qualifications for the job, rather than these kind of individual little pieces that, you know, they may have 100 badges, but if they can't figure out how to put them together in a creative way and to, you know, deliver a product on time with those skills, then they're kind of useless. And so that's one of my worries, is that these. And maybe it's not even a worry. I think it just won't go anywhere because employers are going to look at it that way. Employers are going to look at it and say, well, great, you've got these badges, but what have you done?
Isn't it just another data point to look at, though? I mean, right now, a bachelor's of science in journalism doesn't mean you're a good writer and a good journalist. It means you've reached a certain, you know, you've passed through a few hurdles, but I want to see what you've done. Before I hire you as a journalist, so it's
you can make the same criticism. I'll totally grant that a CS degree doesn't guarantee this person is going to be a successful programmer in a workplace, but at least in the course of getting a degree, you know, there's a curriculum, you have to progress through these stages. You have to meet with someone who advises you on what to do next. Maybe there's a synthetic paper at the end or a synthetic project in your senior year, or if you're in master's and doing a project as a master's thesis or something that actually does give you something you can show. So I agree that that all credentials can be picked apart in this way, but I think the more granular they are, the more easily they can be picked apart.
I guess that's what I'm saying, is it's just another thing. I wouldn't say don't look at whether they have a degree and don't ignore their experience. But, badges doesn't hurt anything. It's just another data point to look at for whatever value it ends up being when it's used.
I think it's a data point that makes you look dumb. Like, I don't know.
Well, I think, our sort of petty concern here is that, funding for education is incredibly limited. And if the resources are being put into this kind of program, then they're being taken away from some other kind of program that might be more useful. So I think it's an experiment, and I think it should be taken in that, it should be considered as such. And, I think we'll see where it goes. And I think there will be a lot of creative people working on trying to make this work. And I think we'll see where it ends up.
What's upgraded Tom Scheinfeld's badge to gold for that sage commentary. Oh. And I'm afraid we need to wrap it up here. But Tom Merritt, it is great to have you on the podcast. We really appreciate you taking your time.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. It's a good conversation.
Tom Merritt at tommerritt.com on the Twit Network at twit.tv. And again, it's great to have you on. I hope we can have you back at some point.
Thanks. Yeah, I'd love to.
Tom, is there anything particular you're working on right now that you'd like to tell our listeners about?
Well, Amanda, I'm glad you asked. I just published a book, I may have alluded to, that Amanda French helped edit. So big thanks to her. And if you're interested in it, you can download a free version or buy a print version at unitedmooncolonies.squarespace.com. Or you can also find a link to that at tommerritt.com.
Link to that from the show notes. Tom Scheinfeld, Mills Kelly, and Amanda French, always great to talk to you. And we'll talk to everyone again in a couple of weeks on another edition of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv. where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself. Thank you.